It's the Last Call podcast with Chris Michaels, and tonight is my very special guest, Michael LaFlemme. He is a researcher, adjunct professor of history and philosophy, and a columnist for New Dawn magazine. Michael was also a historical consultant to director Oliver Stone and ghostwrites for many authors. His most recent book, Visions of Atlantis, Reclaiming Our Lost Ancient Legacy, was self-published back in December, where he delves into many historical names that are pivotal in Atlantean research. If you want, you can go pick it up on Amazon, and I believe it's soon to be on Kindle, as well as an audio book, if I'm not mistaken. And finally, if that's not enough, he is also a scuba diver and a guitarist, just like your lovable host. I am also a scuba diver, and I also play the 12-string acoustic guitar. Michael, thank you very much for being on the Last Call podcast.
Wow, quite an introduction now. Thank you. And that's cool. You're a scuba diver and you play 12-string. That's awesome, man.
I do. I played violin for about 9 years before I moved over to a guitar. Wow. Of course, you know, being someone starved for attention, I couldn't just pick up a 6-string. I had to pick up a 12-string.
They're great.
Yeah. So tell me about your book, Visions of Atlantis. I know that on the description that you can easily read, you focus on Edgar Cayce and Rudolf Steiner, people like that.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because when I was doing, you know, first getting into this this subject, you know, the first book I think that I really read that got me, you know, to take this quite seriously was Ignatius Donnelly's The Antediluvian World. You know, like so many people, I think it's quite interesting, that book that, you know, is 140 years old now and still in print. And, you know, people love to attack that book and say, you know, Donnelly was looking for Atlantis in, you know, all sorts of places, and, you know, he found it everywhere he went, which, you know, got me thinking, because in the Cayce readings that I had also seen, it filled in a lot of the gaps that Donnelly had not been able to really solve, you know, when he saw evidence in the Americas, in the Basque Country, in parts of North Africa. Yeah. People naturally said, well, that's not what Plato said. Plato said it was a, you know, mid-Atlantic large island that had a couple colonies in the Mediterranean. So how could this be? And so the clairvoyant visions from people like Cayce, Rudolf Steiner, or the Theosophist, along with what I think is the most detailed and, you know, compelling exegesis of the Frederick Oliver's text, Clairaudiently Channeled Text, A Dweller on Two Planets, which was written in 1886, just a couple years after The Antediluvian World came out, which really shocked me, because I think what happened with a lot of these things is that most of the people that had talked about these clairvoyant visions that, you know, themselves were close to the source or writing in the 40s and 50s and had access to, you know, some of Cayce's clients or themselves were people that knew Cayce, I think a lot of people have forgotten those sources, you know, because Cayce has kind of just been rolled over into a lot of, you know, other new age channelers, and people have forgotten that he's still one of the most incredible sources for that specific topic, and has, you know, 500 approximately readings specifically on Atlantis, where he basically explains, you know, that this was not just the civilization Plato was describing. Plato would have been describing the final iteration before the third and final destruction. Right. But that in fact there existed, you know, three, if you want to call them, iterations of this culture that spanned roughly from, you know, depending on how you read it, you know, 75,000 or even 100,000 BC up to the very specific date, 50,722 BC, which he places for the first destruction, second at 28,000 BC, and final around 10,000 BC, which is very close to what Plato said in his two dialogues. So I really took the opportunity to, you know, like a crime scene investigator for the past 7 years, take all those readings from Steiner, from Barbara Hand Cloud, more modern channeler from the 80s and 90s, you know, even some Dolores Cannon, some Cayce, and try to really just storyboard, you know, all these different sources and see where they line up, and then see if I could corroborate that with historical, geological, oceanographic, genetic, or, you know, cultural evidence, kind of like what Donnelly did. And so in, you know, my attempt, I guess, was to really make like the sequel to the antediluvian world with clairvoyant sources as the kind of, you know, special sauce to bring in a clear vision, so to speak, of a time that, you know, if it were as described by Plato or any of these historical sources as existing that far away, the only, you know, ironically, the only evidence we would have of like what lived reality was like would have been through these channeled sources. And so I think that's kind of the strength of the book, is that it adds a kind of vividness to these rather dry descriptions that, you know, Donnelly and other people, you know, wrote, because they were just dealing with, you know, fragments or remnants or traces, so to speak, you know.
Oh, yeah. Sure. I mean, it's very interesting to have to compile all of that data together and try to make it, I guess, functional, for lack of a better term.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people will try to shoot down whatever you say when you're saying that, oh, I'm getting this information from a channeled source. Yeah. Now, I've done channeling myself, and I've done it. Only one time have I gone back to Atlantis.
Wow.
And that, during that time, it was, I was being brought through what they called a rookery. That's the phrase. That's the word that popped up.
Really?
And what is a rookery, right? It's almost like a I don't know, where kids are, right? It's almost like a play thing. Like, I can't think of the name. I don't have kids. So, you know, it's almost like a play date. It's where kids go at preschool. There you go. Couldn't think of the word.
Right.
And it was run by women. It was all female.
Mm-hmm.
But what was interesting is that it was all outdoors, and it was kind of in like a stall kind of atmosphere, not a bathroom stall, but I'm talking about with straw, almost like a farm like atmosphere.
Wow.
And the children that were there weren't entirely human. So you remember all of those channelings about how you had, you know, chimeras involved in all of this.
This is very interesting, because I have a whole chapter on that. And in fact, that to me was the most difficult chapter to write. And I'm very proud of, you know, what I achieved, because those, even by, you know, I think the hardcore Casey, you know, believers are the hardest to really wrap your mind around, because as you know, might have read in Casey's descriptions, you know, a lot of people interpret that as genetic engineering, and certainly that could play a part. But in Casey's readings, you know, in his cosmology, the evolution of human beings was not Darwinian evolution. In fact, he actually categorically refutes the idea that human beings evolved directly from primates in a reading. And he says basically that, you know, human evolution took place over millions of years through thought forms from the astral plane entangling in third dimensionality with flora, fauna, and mineral kingdoms on Earth. And that over time, some of those people, you know, became these kind of chimeric creatures that naturally evolved and that were, you know, intermingling with later humans that incarnated in much more, you know, akin to like what our bodies look like today, which would have been further removed from like the purely animal world. And so a big part of his story of, you know, multiple iterations of the Atlantean Empire is, how do we like legally, morally deal with this mutant species? You know, so that's very interesting that you say that you saw that, because in his vision, for some of them, I think around 25,000 BC, there's a reading where he's talking about like one of his clients was a woman who was like an advocate for these people who worked in the fields.
Right. Yeah.
And the sons of Belial, who were kind of like the empire from Star Wars in this, you know, Casey cosmology, were basically using these people as slaves and doing all sorts of things, using them as sex slaves, labor slaves.
Exactly. And
yeah, so that's really, that's quite interesting, because there's really very little information, you know, in his readings on that specifically. And so it was interesting to see from other cultures, if I could find any corroborating evidence of this, you know, episode in history. And, you know, I was actually quite surprised, you know, in the Book of Jasher, an apocryphal book from the Bible, they talk about this. And then in the Babylonian version of the Book of Genesis, they actually talk about a genetic manipulation program where a certain temple, all these chimeras were created, you know, and then they say these were preserved in stone reliefs that you can find at the temple of Belos, which is interesting because Belos is a Greek word for Bel in Chaldean, which would have been Baal in Phoenician or Belial in the Bible. And Casey said these people were called the sons of Belial.
Right.
So again, it all kind of makes sense if you actually pay attention to details and have the historical training to see that Casey was not just randomly saying things that sound fantastical. He was actually just conveying something that he himself, because he was just a Sunday school teacher with no historical training, didn't even understand.
You know, exactly.
People explained it to him, basically.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. So that's why I thought he was a very important source, because it's very hard to, for example, in the handful of modern channelers that I use from the 2000s and the 90s, and the end of the book, and I say in that chapter, the chapter is called a speculative fiction, because unlike Casey, who has a 14,000 plus reading track record and was documented by Harvard, Stanford, Princeton doctors who could not explain his powers, it's very difficult to say if a modern channeler who's already read Casey and seen Star Wars and Stargate Atlantis is actually...
Yeah, yeah.
And so
how much is being skewed? Yeah,
I don't like to use a lot of those types of things to make strong arguments, you know, but I find them interesting.
No, I agree with you. I agree with you. I have another channeling that I did, and I won't go into it now, but it is from Move.
Wow.
And that was a very intense channeling in a very positive way.
Wow.
I'll just describe it briefly, because I want to go back to your chapter in the book about chimeras. Uh-huh. So basically this channeling occurred a long time ago. The scenery was basically like a Caribbean island or a Pacific island. Obviously, if it's Mu, it's going to be out in that direction.
Sure.
And it was a nighttime scene. And it was at a time when the planets were not as out of alignment as they are today. So if you could picture all of these planets a lot closer so that you can actually see them, assuming you believe in the heliocentric model, right? Not the...
No, sure,
not the...
sure.
Not the
sure.
flat earth kind of deal.
Sure.
Then you can imagine that. And then if you're not entirely corporeal, right? You are right. A spiritual, energetic human being.
Right.
There was actually communication between all of the planets and all of these beings at different spheres at certain times of the year.
Very interesting.
So they would go back and forth, and the scene that I remember are all of these energies. Basically, it's like a skipping stone, right? Mm-hmm. They were skipping down from these planets through a triangular, almost gateway, coming down onto Earth for a celebration. It was extremely
wow.
fun.
That's extremely an awesome. Fun. That's an amazing, you know, image. You know, and it's so fascinating because, just from what little you told me, in one of the chapters, I believe, in the chapter Spirits in the Material World, you know, I really try to show to the best of my ability from multiple Casey readings that were unrelated how he explains that process, you know, and he even puts a date on it. He puts the date at 10.5 million BC.
Yeah.
And he says that process basically took place in the what we would call today roughly the American Southwest, you know, mm-hmm. which he would have claimed would have like been the far right, far eastern border of Lemuria. And yeah, it's a similar thing, you know, to what you just said.
That, very interesting.
That these thought forms kind of came down and were not fully materialized until millions of years later when they kind of consciously or some cases unconsciously, you know, went into this much deeper density and became kind of trapped, you know,
which right.
itself is a theosophical, I think that's the definition of theosophy, is that, you know, human beings are divine sparks cut off from a source. So a lot of people have said, well, you know, he was just friends with a lot of theosophists and things like this. But, you know, it's difficult to say, because it's like, either way, it doesn't really matter to me, you know, whether he was influenced by theosophy or whether theosophy was telling a version of the truth that he later confirmed. It's like, I think people spend too much time on, you know, who said what, instead of just looking at the data and then looking at what other cultures that have never encountered theosophy or Western, you know, belief systems have themselves said, you know. And in many cases, you know, the Hopi creation myth is exactly that, you know, or the creation myth of the Iroquois tribe is extremely similar. And it's like, well, did those people read theosophy? No.
Right. Yeah. Right. Exactly. So,
oral tradition. So.
So you triggered me for two things, right? The first one I'm going to bring up is another channeling I did. Actually, it was a regression. I went through a Dolores Cannon style regression.
Wow. Quantum regression. Wow.
And it was a whopping 3 hours of me not shutting up.
Oh my God. You actually, you know, it's so interesting, because I was thinking about getting certified to do that.
So was I. Yeah.
Wow.
So what reminds me of that session is what you brought up about Hopi and Iroquois legend. So I think it's the Hopi where we're in the fourth or fifth world, right?
Yes.
Okay. So basically, for anybody that doesn't know, you have multiple big bangs, multiple spiritual big bangs. And with each big bang, there's a greater sense of awareness, and then there's a collapse, another explosion of awareness that builds on the prior, and you just keep going into these cycles.
Right.
So during this regression, I got very upset and emotional. I kept saying the pylon cracked and I failed.
Wow.
Now, do you know what a pylon is?
Yeah.
Okay, so do you know what the ancient version of a pylon is?
Like a column?
Okay, so if you go into Google Images and just type in pylon, Egyptian, it is basically a massive post and lintel. So a big, big entranceway that is essentially guarded by two obelisks.
Okay.
And so what I found out was, is that at the beginning of that next world that we were trying to repopulate, those pylons were basically gateways for any stragglers to come through.
Interesting.
And what happened was that there was this bit of darkness that came through, and it was so powerful that it cracked the pylon.
Wow.
And this darkness was allowed to leak in.
Wow.
Now, the odd part about that is that it sounds evil. But I said that this darkness isn't evil. It just doesn't know what to do. So it's almost as if it is just acting in its inherent form.
Right. And that's a, I think, as I got into my investigation of what you just said, you know, evil and its entrance into the, you know, third dimension, and the kind of perennial struggle that Casey describes between these two factions, it appears that, you know, that's a much more, I think, interesting and nuanced way to look at it, because it's like, is it just something that hates everything? And I think, no, it's, you know, it's exactly what you said. It's something that's essentially, you know, ignorant, which I believe is, you know, something that Plato, I believe, said something to that effect. You know, it's evil is ignorance, and, you know, something that is self-seeking and kind of itself an, you know, alien, you know, if you want to think of it as an artificial or non-natural intelligence that kind of works its way into, you know, our world. And it's interesting, because in the Casey readings, you know, those two factions, you know, the Children of the Law of One and the Sons of Belial, they weren't just cookie cutter, you know, like a lot of the people from the, you know, the Law of One were themselves corrupted, you know, willingly by the allure of materialism and hedonism. And a lot of people on the other side, you know, saw that what they were doing was, you know, hitting a point where it was probably going to destroy civilization, and then they abandoned that. And so I think it's much more interesting than just two like diametrically opposed things, you know. And I remember, I think it was Michael Tsarian talking about that, because he had discussed that at length in his book, which I hadn't read until after finishing my book. But you know how in the Hermetic tradition, as opposed to the Gnostic tradition, you know, in the Gnostic tradition, I guess you could look at it as human beings being deceived by an archontic presence and, you know, the demiurge and all this, and a fundamental distinction between good and bad. But in the Hermetic tradition, it's more just kind of like a circular spectrum that is neither good nor bad intrinsically, but that you can kind of explore at will, you know, in a kind of range. And if you get too far, you kind of go back. And I think that's interesting, because it's more like human, and it's more believable than just, you know, ultimate good and ultimate evil, you know. And that was something I really tried to show in the Casey readings, because I found some really rare readings that had never been included in any book on Edgar Casey that I really had to dig for. And, you know, showed how a lot of people who asked him, you know, like one woman said, who was I in a past life? And he went through, I think, six lives until he got her back to the final destruction of Atlantis. And he said, you know, at this time you were putting people through a sacrificial flame, a mass execution. Mm-hmm. And then they were dumping the ashes of those people on the circular rings of the city to drink, you know. And she was a Catholic 20-year-old girl who was going to school, you know, in the United States. And it's like, that's a huge...
Yeah, right.
It's a hugely different thing you were doing back then, you know. That, and another girl was, you know, because it says in the transcript, you know, Protestant housewife, 20 or something like that. And another girl was, you know, a priestess in 28,000 BC in the Temple of Light. And she was part of the Children of the Law of One. But she was having affairs with 17 different, you know, sons of Belial, and had 17 different children with 17 fathers. And they said that nobody really could do anything because she was so powerful, and she took care of her kids and everything. But, you know, she was getting down with the dark side, you know? So it's yeah. And that part's in bold. So that means Casey's voice went up, because that's how the transcript read. He said 17 kids with 17 different Belial, you know? And it's like, so, I mean, I think what's interesting is that these cases that he brings up, you know, from the specifically Atlantean timeline, because I didn't focus too much on Lemuria, although I put it in context, but I wanted to focus the book on Atlantis. But,
sure,
you know, it's based on the world, you know, and yeah, okay, fine. It takes place on some arbitrary number that seems really far away, but it wouldn't be that strange if you went back as a person living in 2023, you know, on arguably the cusp of recovering, you know, primitive Atlantean technology, if you want to think of it that way. If you were to go back to, you know, one of these iterations when they had reached high technology, it wouldn't appear, you know, strange or foreign at all. It would actually appear like most science fiction or futurist novels, you know, that we go to the movies to see. And so,
exactly.
I think what's so crazy is that when he gave these readings, you know, in the 30s, 20s, and 40s, what people then were thinking, because it's like, he's talking about things when people didn't even have televisions, you know?
Yeah, totally. I agree with that too. So real quick, if you were to sum up, because some people may not know the difference, what were the two major, I know them, but some people may not. What were the two major cultural breakaways in Atlantis? Two major cultural factions. What were they? Belial. And yeah, the Law of One, right?
That's right. The sons of Belial and the children of the Law of One. And again, you know, it's interesting because Casey claims that racially, the original race of the Atlantean landmass and later the islands were people who would have looked identical to people from the Iroquois tribe, you know? And I always love it when people, you know, occasionally I'll step into the ring with people on Reddit and things like this.
Why? Why?
You know, just because, I don't know, I'm a sadist or something, but...
Clearly.
Occasionally, I'll see somebody say something, and I'll go, hey, did you ever think about this? And then, bing, 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 my phone goes off, and you know, you racist, you... And I always tell people, like, well, first of all, you know, I mean, my father is black, my mother is white, so I don't think I'm a racist. I'm not trying to promote racial supremacy against, you know, half of my own genetics. But more importantly, I tell people, you know, if you had actually read the Casey readings, he would tell you straight up that being what he called the red race in the language of his time, Native American, indigenous,
right, exactly,
North American, Native American race, that he specifically attributes to the Iroquois, who he calls were pure descendants of Atlantis, that was the race that was involved in all of this high technology. So quite the contrary, Casey is saying that the highest technological advancements in human history were produced by Native Americans, and that they interacted with all the other races of the world because they were a global culture. So you would have had mixtures of people in Atlantis that were white and Native American, or white and black, or Asian and black, just like today. That's why I say it's a modern story. But the original race that he claimed was a fivefold incarnation at the same time, you know, the white race in the Caucasus Mountains, the Asian race in the Gobi Desert, black race near Sudan, I believe he puts it, what he calls the brown race near the Andes Mountains, and the red race on the island of Atlantis, you know, which would have been a continent at that time. You know, that's very interesting to me, because it's like the main critique of any of these things from all these idiots that, you know, love to hate on, you know, Hancock and all these people, is like they only talk about, you know, Viracocha and this white man that brought knowledge from the ocean. And it's like, well, first of all, you know, Graham Hancock didn't invent the myth of Viracocha. So if you think, you know, the Maya and the Aztecs are racist because they believed that, you know, at one point a white man with a beard came out of the ocean, then, you know, take it up with them. Yeah. But what's more interesting to me is that in this Casey timeline, it's kind of the opposite, and shows the real racism of the Europeans in the 19th, 20th century who made the Native Americans look savage. You know, when in fact, if the Casey timeline is true, and I believe there's a lot to suggest it is, then it really, in the past, the Native American race had reached the highest point of material, you know, achievement, technologically, in human history, you know. And so when you see the Palenque coffin or things like this, and people say, hey, maybe that guy's looking through a telescope, or maybe that's a spaceship or something like that, it's like, well, that makes sense in the context of the Casey readings. But if you actually are a racist who goes on Reddit and calls other people racist, then you can't imagine that. You know, you think that's just ceremony.
Nah, it's just virtue signaling nonsense, in my opinion. And you know what? You can't talk to them. Because
no,
you know,
that's why I stepped into the
why
ring.
Why even bother? You know, I have a master's degree. You've got a master's degree.
Right.
It doesn't pay.
No, it doesn't pay.
That's why I do a podcast where nobody can respond to me, you know?
You know, and I understand absolutely now why people, you know, basically write a book and, you know, step behind their publisher and editor, because this field, as you've said, I'm sure, you know, even just with your podcast, it's like, it's a field that's really emotionally charged. And it's not just charged with these people that we just talked about who, you know, call ancient apocalypse and all these things racist and all this BS, but it's also charged, I think, even more so with people who have invested so much time on one narrative being true, you know?
Yeah.
And that's
yeah.
the same with the ancient aliens hypotheses or just the modern, you know, UFO totally. Phenomenon. And it's like, I really prided myself on, like, I love when people read my book and tell me, like, hey, you know, have you ever thought about this? Or do you really think that this happened at this point? Because I have a channeling that suggests this. And I'm like, no, that's awesome, you know, because to me, I was never trying to prove, you know, my point. I was just trying to put together a story that I had never seen done in the way that I did it, so that it opened up a conversation for other people to share their experiences and say, oh, you know, that reminds me of the time I had a regression and I saw mutant children, you know, in the Atlanta
School of Mutants. Yeah. That's the way it is. Because, you know, I find out also, being on the more energetic side, because I'm also a Reiki master and all of that, it's not so much that you want to enlighten people with your point of view. It's that you want to bring out that same enlightenment that is inherent in all of these people, but they're afraid to say it.
Well, that's an interesting way to look at it.
How many times I get, this may sound crazy, but... So this kind of mindset that you and I have is not uncommon. What is uncommon is people that are free enough to express what they already know deep down inside with somebody that accepts them.
Wow, that's really well put. And you know, it's funny because when I published the book, like a month later, I sent a copy and a letter to my old graduate advisor, who was this very conservative, very genius World War II professor who I love. He was one of my favorite professors. And I said, hey, Dr. Gallately, you know, he's still there at Florida State. And he said, yes, I am. I said, well, you know, I never published a book on World War II, which I studied with you. And he's a world authority on the subject, you know. And I said, but I did publish a book on Atlantis. You know, I just wanted to tell you, you know, thank you. And his response was so funny. He said, basically, he's like, I'm amazed that you had the courage to publish a book like this. And I'm so proud of you because, you know, without saying it, he was saying basically like in academia, you know, this wouldn't even fly.
Of course not.
Laughed out of the history department.
Drum you out of existence. You wouldn't have a job.
Right. So I thought that was so nice that he said, I'm proud that you had, because it means that he probably believes in this.
Of course.
Doesn't really talk about it, you know?
Right. When I was on, before, all right, so one last story. But when I was on terrestrial radio, so AM and FM radio, I would have a bunch of people, professors, I even had a dean one time, call up the show during a commercial and say, I wish I could say what you're saying. But if I do, I will get fired.
And, you know, that's why I spent a whole chapter, not a subchapter, an entire chapter on that I call the parallax view. That is directly, it's like we take a break specifically from the evidence and we just look at this exact topic, you know. And I cite all these cases from Slate Magazine, National Geographic, this, that, and the other thing, where all of these people who themselves know very little about the topic, but were tasked with a hit piece that week by their editor, who basically just expressed what you just said, like ad hominem attacks, or, oh, you know, nobody really believes in Atlantis. Or my favorite was from Slate, you know, Plato used Atlantis as an allegory to explain, you know, Athenian politics, and everybody knows.
Sure.
Right. And I'm like, I mean, and that's the one point in the book where I actually viciously attack these people with my full powers, you know, and I don't like to flex like that, but I had to do it because that kind of person, you know, is the reason that so many other people who could bring forth evidence, you know, just like with the UFO community, it's like there's thousands of people who have seen things or had abduction experiences or you name it, that know if I say this, especially with that, I mean, you're done.
Right.
You know, I mean, airline pilots have lost their jobs for saying things like that.
Yep. Absolutely.
So, you know, I think nobody's going to lose their job, maybe at, you know, a non-academic job for believing in Atlantis. But the people who need to be talking about it really won't. Because as you said, if you're in a Harvard Department of Egyptology, that pyramid was built by Khufu, or you're not getting tenure, period.
Exactly. And so that brings me an interesting topic, because I was always under the contention that Egypt was not Egyptian. It was Atlantean, and Egyptians just kind of stumbled into it. And I think there's even a Casey reading where it talks about these Atlanteans coming into the area with their golem-like creatures.
Correct. In fact, he says things. He never uses any other word, thing or automaton. And it's very interesting because people have suggested a lot of these people were bodies without souls, you know?
Yes.
That, and I think that's correct because at the time Casey was writing that or reading that in the 30s, cloning wasn't widely known or even practiced. So his use of automaton was like all he could do. But John Van Auken suggested that perhaps these were like soulless human vehicles that have been
very good.
And I was like, that's a very interesting thing that I had never thought of, as well as these mutants that had naturally entangled with animal matter and through some sort of genetic, you know, process that I guess has been
lost,
were able to themselves reproduce on some level. However, it's not just one reading. In fact, I could pass this to you if you're interested. There's a publicly available collection, circulating file from the ARE of every reading with a collated timeline of the Atlanteans coming to Egypt that I read probably 10 times to write this book. And it's exactly what you said. These people left in 10,500 BC, Casey said. They went to Giza. They went to the Pyrenees, which they had been going to before. Then they went to Yucatan. And in the case of Giza, yeah, you're right. They brought these mutants, and they then themselves intermixed with the already existing Egyptian culture. And then there was an invasion led by Edgar Casey himself as the exiled priest Ra-Ta from the Caucasus region.
Yes,
and he ended up fighting with all three of these groups. And that's why you have this very strange genetic mixture in Egypt where you see sculptures that look black or this or that. And so as time went on, I guess, you know, the dynastic Egyptians, you know, that's a period of time that's very difficult to explain because Casey, to my knowledge, he doesn't really talk too much because after 10,000 BC, let's say roughly, once the pyramid is completed, which he says was completed in 10,490 BC, there's a cataclysm, and then the trail kind of goes dark. And then you have the emergence of dynastic Egypt, you know, whenever that is. Technically, I'm not an Egyptologist, like the 40th century BC, something like that. But those intermingling years, it's like, who really knows? And so that's the dead zone that people say is responsible for this. Well, there could never be anything before that because, but it's like, yeah, but what about this catastrophe that, if you're being honest, we know absolutely happened. What it was, who can really say? Carrington event, solar flare, comet, this, that. But if you think of it that way, like, yeah, civilization was curtailed around 10,000 BC, and it took 6,000 years probably to reboot. But that doesn't preclude the existence of a prehistoric, quote-unquote,
civilization.
And I think you're right that the Egyptians themselves, from their king's lists or from, you know, certain other traditions, would suggest that there was an age before this that was much more advanced. And that explains in many ways how a culture appears more advanced at the beginning than at the end.
100%. And I want to do this quickly because I know that we don't have a lot of time left.
Sure.
But I want to go to Credo Moto's book, Zulu Shaman. Sure. And he talks about... He talks about the origins of evil. And to basically sum it up, there was this woman who has a kid. The kid is basically maimed, right? Okay. He has a lot of birth defects, couldn't do anything. Mm-hmm. During that time, parents used to take their children to this type of two-headed rainbow-colored bird to give the child a name.
Okay.
This bird told the mother to kill the child. The mother couldn't do it, so she hid the child away and herself in a cave. And they basically lived off fish and crawfish and shrimp or whatever else you have in South Africa.
Okay. Right.
Until one day she comes back down into the cave. And this little weasel created something that is extremely disturbing. And I'll read you the description.
Sure.
Legs like those of a grasshopper, a pair of dragonfly wings, and a rat-like shining metal tail with a sting, a crystal sting with dark green poison. Now, do you know what that sounds like?
What's
if
that?
If you brush up on Revelation 9, you find the same exact description.
Wow. Yes, you know what? The stinger. You're right with the stinger.
Exactly.
That is truly weird.
And they, in Revelation, I think they have like metal vests or something like that. And for Credo Motois' version, basically this thing was made out of metal and stone. So eventually this thing kills the mother, and then this thing goes and procreates and attacks all kinds of other people.
Oh my God.
And they call them Tokoloshes.
Tokoloshe, right. Right.
So they go around and they bother everybody from, you know, here to eternity. But what happens is, and there's a magnificent battle that occurs, because what happens is these metallic beings and this evil being go against humanity. And he also talks about an angelic realm and these birds, these whole race of birds that I referenced before. And they have this titanic battle.
Okay.
Eventually, evil wins in this case. And so what you find out is that these Tokoloshes, in order to win over the human population, are basically turned into servants for mankind, to the point where they turn so lazy that they don't even chew their food anymore. And also, they no longer care to procreate because they are so indulged in physical pleasure.
Okay.
So what brings all this around,
right, sure,
is that eventually the originator, the progenitor of evil, goes into the forests and scoops up all of these animals, all of these trees, all of these Tokoloshes, and puts them into a big pot, mixes them all together. Mm-hmm. And what do they create? They create a golem.
Wow.
And these golem cannot resist the orders of the main bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
And so once again, there's a huge titanic battle that involves the Tree of Life and the mother... the mother goddess of all of this. And eventually the mother goddess, you know, she weeps, and that's where you get all the flood myths.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And this evil guy creates floating cities, crystalline cities all over the place. Ultimately, you know, that turns into he's defeated. But the point is that they do have these golems that are all around.
And, you know, it's like, So many other traditions talk about it, you know, and again, depending on which translation you have of different things, it's like, you know, a lot of people, of course, I'm sure, as you know, talk about when, you know, the sons of God mixed with the daughters of man and things like this. And, you know, in the Book of Jasher, it's much more explicit, where it says it taught, you know, basically a similar type character taught people how to mate and reproduce with the beast to create this new group of people. And then, like I said, in the Chaldean or the Babylonian myth of creation, which I think was translated in the times of Alexander the Great into Greek, I think by Berossus or something like that, you know, they talk about a breeding program, like a laboratory, like an island of Dr. Moreau, you know. And in Barbara Hand Clow's accounts of her past life in one of the Atlantean experiences, she specifically says, you know, I worked for a Pleiadian scientist, technocrat king, who had chipped, you know, a whole population of human beings and was basically a transhumanist and had been doing experiments on people and mixing them. And it's like, you know, all of these things over time, and then, you know, I also show in the book modern cases of this, you know, mm-hmm. where they have already produced chimeric human pig hybrids that they killed at the 3-month period. But they said themselves, if we had brought these to term, it would have been a mutant.
That I find most disturbing.
Right. And they say, of course, they always say, well, we're just doing it because we're trying to get organs that we can, you know, use for transplants and this. But, you know, if that's what they're telling you, then you absolutely know they have created one of these, whether it lived, whether it was viable, probably not to reproduce, probably sterile like a mule. But the fact that this is going on today, when if you compare our technology with the purported advanced technology that Casey and others described, you know, if we can do that now, I mean, we could definitely clone human beings now. They've said as much, and they probably have done that. I think in China, they have done that. That's been reported, yeah, you know, by whistleblowers. But it's like, if we can do that now, well, let's think if, you know, a portion of our society was fully, you know, unethical and had no, you know, international community protecting it or scrutiny or anything, of course they're going to do that, you know? And that's probably where we get these modern echoes in fiction, you know? And, you know, the Clone Wars in Star Wars or all of this, you know, I think is directly not just a product of these people reading the Casey readings, which I don't think anybody on Lucas's team did.
No, I think you could be wrong about that. Lucas is not. I think somebody on Lucas's side or Spielbergo's side, I think they definitely had readings, because if you look at the genesis of the word Jedi,
right?
What are we talking about here? And why does the Death Star look like the moon?
Right.
You know, what's the real hidden meaning behind all of that? And this inherent force that everyone has access to.
Right. It is actually, and I actually talk about that for a couple pages in the conclusion of the book, which is to say that, you know, officially Lucas claims, oh, I just had talks with Joseph Campbell and, you know, this and that. But I really looked at it like they were directly copying Frederick Oliver's book, A Dweller on Two Planets, because there are things in that book that, if they weren't copying, then it just validates my argument that he was telling the truth. Because in 1886, he was talking about, well, I'm flying over Africa right now in my ship, which is a cigar-shaped ship that's entrained to a crystal, and I'm talking to a princess on a holographic projector.
Well, gee, where did we see that?
Yeah, and right? He said that in 1886. And that book was, and this is another weird thing I found in my investigation, I actually found a 1941 court case where the estate of Frederick Oliver was suing another author for copyright infringement or plagiarism. Mm-hmm. And the judge said, no, because if you look at the preface, your son claims this book was channeled. And so it falls under the same jurisdiction as the Book of Mormon or the Bible. It's free. You know, it's in the public domain, so anybody can copy it. And when I saw that, I was like, that book had already been out since 1905. Somebody on Lucas's team read A Dweller on Two Planets.
Yes, that makes sense. I'm going to have to look up that book.
It's a beautiful book. And I actually have probably a 25-page chapter where I go through all the things in that book that he could not have known in 1886. Mm-hmm. That later came true, you know, and I'll give you just one teaser. You know, he says very casually, because Frederick Oliver claims to have gotten clairaudient voices from a person named Philos, who wanted Oliver to tell his past life in the year 11,160 BC on the island of Poseid in the Atlantean Empire. That's the background. And so Oliver starts writing this thing that turns into like a 400-page book. And it's crazy. And in one part, he says basically like, you know, we're flying over this region of the world. And, you know, they fly over the region where the Nazca lines are. He specifically cites the Atacama Desert. He says, we're going here. He says, we're going to our copper mines in Lake Superior. Well, it turns out there is a 4,000 plus mining complex in Lake Superior with Minoan markings on it that they can't explain. He also says, we're now flying over the Amazon. And he says, you know, the Amazon, this is in 1886 he made this claim. He says, you know, the Amazon is actually an old Atlantean garden, and all the things we brought from Poseid we cultivated here. And it's like, until very recently, you know, I cite an article from like 3-4 years ago And I think Graham Hancock touched on this in his book, America, before. But we now know that around 10,000 BC, or, you know, they don't know exactly when, but around 10 to 8,000 BC, the Amazon had been cultivated. And they don't know by whom. And it's like, how did he know that in 1886?
Interesting.
So I really focus on things like that. Like if I say this, Chandler said this, or I'm describing something, the next paragraph is, you know, a mainstream, quote unquote, scientific, geological, oceanographic, you know, evidence that supports that claim or does not, you know?
Wow. That's fascinating.
I think it's a different book because usually it's, you know, here's an archaeology book on megalithic architecture, and that's great. Or here's all of Edgar Cayce's readings on Atlantis, and that's great. But how do you combine the two so that people can really see that this is more than just
fiction?
Yeah.
Have you ever tried to read Zachariah Sitchin?
You know, I've only read one of his books.
That was Dry Toast with Swiss Cheese and Mayonnaise. I couldn't get through it's that. Rough. It is just so technical for most
it's
of it.
It's rough and it's not enjoyable.
No, it isn't.
Apparently, and again, I'm not an expert on cuneiform, but according to people I really respect, a lot of that take with a grain of salt, you know?
Yep. Absolutely. Okay, so we only have about 10 minutes left, and I want to read to you one little smidgen of that origin of evil. The High Chief Zaralili, that was the main bad guy. By the way, he's also described as having red skin. So that's also interesting. This is after he has taken over mankind and the Tree of Life has tried to destroy him once. So that was the first deluge.
Okay.
So High Chief Zaralili gave humans powers to wish food right into their stomachs. No more need they bruise the gullet with swallowing too hard. Also, the result was inevitable. For every unnatural power the magician bestowed, the people lost their own natural powers. And they even began to feel that begetting and raising children was too much of a strain. These self-indulgent humans were losing the powers of reproduction, and still they thought their life the best the world has ever known.
Wow.
What is going on? That sounds exactly like what's going on today.
It absolutely does, and it also, even down to the phraseology, it's so interesting that at the very end of, I forget if it's Critias or Timaeus, but it's basically the temple priest telling Solon, you know, and at the moment of their greatest power, you know, to him who had an eye to see, they were filled with unrighteous avarice and greed, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's, again, it's this like very cross-cultural thematic link where at the final stage, whatever you want to call that, you know, people had reached this point of, you know, hedonistic sloth and, you know, that was it. And in the Cayce readings, I mean, he says as much, you know, he says basically like if you were granted powers to manipulate matter to, you know, I mean, I'll give you, I found a reading that even I had to laugh, you know, I always think it's great when you can laugh at something you wrote yourself because I don't laugh at much, you know, but, you know, there was a guy who said, and I'll, you know, kind of end on this in terms of this theme, but if you can believe this, on June 6, 1944, while the invasion of Normandy was taking place, there was a guy in the army who didn't go. Instead, he went to get an Edgar Cayce reading. Because his mom or his aunt, this is a true story. His aunt said on June 6, 1944, you know, Saving Private Ryan, go see Mr. Cayce, because they had read Thomas Sugar's biography. So he goes there and he says, who was I in a past life? And this guy's past life was like, well, you were a conquistador and you had a harem of young women. And because of your abuses of this, you ended up killing yourself. He says, okay, that's nice. He says, going back one further, you were in a Persian caravan and you abused slave girls that were coming through there. And then in the final one, he says, basically, you were part of this hedonistic Sons of Belial But at this point, you had the power to basically create life. And you made this harem of the most grotesque to the most beautiful women to be part of your little coterie. And Casey screamed at him at the end. He says, don't make the same mistake again. You know? And I think it's just, look, like you said, man, you know, turn on TMZ, go on Twitter, step into the swamp of Reddit, if you will. Look at where we're going, you know? And I don't think it's a coincidence that all this interest in this subject has suddenly reemerged in like the last 5-6 years. Because I'll be honest with you, when I started writing this book or researching it about 9 years ago, very few people cared about this. And as time went on, I've really seen, as things have particularly gotten crazy in the last 3-4 years,
yep,
people, for some reason, seem to be much more open to discussing this because I think they're seeing it unfold in front
right
of them.
And I still think there's a DNA consciousness, a DNA memory, a soul memory that these people are starting to get triggered with that, yeah, understand that, oh, wait a minute, I've seen this before.
I think that's a really smart way to put it. And I think you're absolutely right.
And I also think that what's going on with 5G and potentially what's been going on with these inoculations, these gene therapy prophylactics,
yep,
I think that is some effort to try and turn off this awakening.
100%.
So I know we don't have a lot of time left, but real quick, what was the most startling revelation that you found whilst writing your book? Now, don't reveal the whole thing. This is a teaser because we want people to buy your book, right?
I do.
So what could you tease us with? Just let us dip our beak a little bit.
Well, I'll never forget this one because I remember calling my friend at 3 a.m. and waking him up because I said, if I get hit by the subway in the, you know, train station in Chicago this morning, you got to share this. And it was a sketch that Frederick Oliver had included in his book in 1886 of what the island of Poseidon looked like, down to rivers, contours, ladders.
Oh, I think we lost you. So that's it. This has been the Last Call podcast with Michael LaFlemme. And just as about he was going to reveal this amazing revelation that he found out, his phone cuts out. So what does that mean? It means that you should go over onto Amazon or wherever you buy your books. Look up Michael LaFlemme. Michael spelled Michael LaFlemme, L-E space F-L-E-M. And look up his book, Visions of Atlantis, Reclaiming Our Lost Ancient Legacy. Buy that book and start reading it and start to understand where he's coming from when he references people like Edgar Cayce and also Rudolf Steiner and what this means for the human race as a whole. So we're going to try to figure out what happened to Michael, but as always, I appreciate your listens. This has been the Last Call podcast with Chris Michaels. You can find me everywhere on social media at Last Call Caravan. And if you want to download, oh, are you there, Michael?
Hey, can you hear
you're
me?
Back. Yes, you're back. Okay, so I'm going to end the spiel. I thought I lost you forever, so I was just going on and improvising. So what happens?
I thought that was part of your show.
No.
Was...
No, well, something happened. You were completely removed.
Well, that's really weird. Maybe I wasn't supposed to reveal it. But I'll leave it on that it really was a... When I saw his sketch... And then I looked at a bathythermic scan, satellite scan, that there's no way he could have had access to. And it lined up and it overlaid almost to the millimeter. I was really shocked because at that point, wow. I thought, all right, this is not just, you know, fun and games. This is something real and it's worth telling, you know, because like I said, I'm more interested in this book being kind of like a icebreaker with some, you know, very advanced, you know, conclusions, but also a kind of, you know, introduction as well for people who maybe want to know more about how channel visions actually line up with geological, archaeological, and oceanographic evidence.
Cultural. Absolutely. I always tell people that if you think you're using your imagination, you're really not. So when you walk into a room and you think people are thinking at you or thinking about you, you know, they're checking me out. Oh, they think, you know, annoying or whatever. You're probably picking up on something, and you can extrapolate that into manifestation and also channeling.
Sure.
So all of that ties together. And I think more and more people are aware of their gifts. So we're at the end of our time. So Michael, where can people find you if they want to, find you? How about that?
Yeah. The best place is you could go on Facebook. I have an author page, and also LinkedIn is usually where I interact with most of the people that read my book. So that's the best place probably right now. And probably in a month or so, I'll have a website set up and I'll give you that information when the time comes. But yeah, for now, you can follow me on LinkedIn, Facebook, and of course, you can always subscribe to my, you know, Amazon author page.
I think that's the best bet. Go over onto Amazon and look up Visions of Atlantis, Reclaiming Our Lost Ancient Legacy. So, Michael, thank you very much for being on the Last Call podcast with Chris Michaels.